Less than 2 weeks into the new year, and the world's wealthiest 1% have already used their fair share of the global carbon budget allocated for 2025. 2024 was the hottest year on record. How can we change our extractive mindset to a regenerative mindset? How can we evolve our systems from economic growth to a vision of regenerative living and eco-civilization?
Dr. Paul Srivastava is co-president of the Club of Rome and professor of management and organizations at Pennsylvania State University. He also founded the UNESCO Chair for Arts and Sustainable Enterprise at ICN Business School in Nancy, France, and the One Division of the Academy of Management, in addition to several private companies and nonprofit organizations. Srivastava also formerly served as the executive director of Future Earth and has published extensively on both sustainable management and crisis management.
Dr. Paul Srivastava, welcome to One Planet Podcast and the Creative Process.
Thank you very much. Looking forward to our conversation.
Well, first, I should say you're a co-president of the Club of Rome. And if I could give a little bit of history for those who don't know, you're coming up soon on your 60th anniversary, the Club of Rome, which is a platform for leading scientists, economists, policy and business leaders to collaborate and promote leading edge thinking, has national associations in 35 countries and territories.
So the Club of Rome is actually a think tank, which was established in late 1960s. And so, yeah, we are in our sixth decade over here, coming up on the 60th anniversary in a few years. But it was established by Aurelio Pace, who was at that time the CEO of Fiat, automobile company in Italy. And his idea was that there were a lot of people thinking about big challenges, global challenges. But the one area that was missing is some kind of long-term thinking on the prospects of humanity surviving in the long run. So he put together this group, and they took on what they call the human problematique, by which they referred to the idea of how do humans survive through both the technological as well as ecological, economic challenges that are forthcoming back in the 1960s. And he designed it as a think tank rather than as a consulting company or as a research company. So it was supposed to be independent. Over the 6 years, it has morphed and transformed, particularly in the last 5 years, huge transformation. So originally the number of members were 100, now they're up to 150. There are a lot more women, a lot more younger people, a lot more people from the global south. So it's not like a club of Italian CEOs' friends anymore. It's much more professional, and it has artists, and it has scientists, and it has politicians and business people. And we pride ourselves in our independent thinking. The method that we have adopted is one of systems analysis. So systemic thinking, how do we change and transform large-scale planetary systems?
Indeed, you need to involve all those actors in society. Obviously, a lot of our supply chains and our business solutions have to take on the circular economy and all that, but you have to bring in all sectors of society, which I really appreciate about the Club of Rome. And it was started there, but I believe you're headquartered in Switzerland. So it truly is around the world. So today I would like for us to talk a little bit about its roots coming up through Fiat and all these things, but I'd like to talk about consumerism and capitalism. You know, we're all a part of it. We all benefit from it, but spurred or accelerated the ecological crisis. And I think it's fair to say that climate change, it's no longer on the distant horizon. Climate change is here. We're in this global warming phase. And so now it's about ecosystem preservation and biodiversity restoration, all these things that are at the forefront of the Club of Rome's projects and just applying common sense. So, you know, for the last 100 plus years, we've had this handful of corporations extract and burn through what took the planet 300 million years to form, these oil and gas deposits that we call fossil fuels. And we can see that as a species, we are very good at taking things from the planet. But, you know, how do we restore that? How do we go about being better stewards of the earth rather than bad tourists trashing our home?
Yeah, good. I'm glad that we don't have to dwell on the nature of the problem itself or the scale of the problem or whether it is here or not. I am in full agreement. Climate change is here. It's already causing devastation to the most vulnerable populations. We are living with an extractive mindset, as you pointed out, and we need to change from that mindset to a regenerative mindset. And we need to change from the North Star of economic growth to a vision of eco-civilizations. So those are the two main principles that I want to propose and that the Club of Rome suggests that we try to transform our current organization towards regenerative living and eco-civilization. So let me say a few words about each. These are not just our ideas. There are many other thinkers outside the Club of Rome who also written about it. So regenerative living means that the system that sustains us, we need to give back to it. We can't just one way extract out of it, whether it is fossil fuels, which you pointed out, or agriculture. Just extracting out of the earth without sustaining the soil is not a way that we can live for the long run. So for us, regenerativity or regenesis, it can be applied in many areas. There's already a big community of regenerative agriculture. There is regenerative medicine, where people are thinking of regenerating at the cell level for health. There is even talk about regenerative economies, circular economies, and regenerative finance. So it's a principle that applies in many different areas, and we are trying to articulate that sector by sector because it's not just a question of knowledge, it's also a question of values and mindsets. We need transformation at many scales, and all the life support systems that we have now, whether they are food, water, energy, transportation, entertainment, education, the way our societies are organized, many of them are premised on that extractive model, and we need to switch to the regenerative model. And where we want to take the world is not some kind of abstract economic growth utopia where everybody has a certain level of income, but a place where the earth systems are in balance, they are healthy, and they are supporting life. So we call this eco-civilization with the idea that we want to see an integrated development of humans and nature in a kind of mutual harmony and balance with each other. I mean, both Eastern philosophies and Western philosophies have multiple ways of expressing what an eco-civilization is. Many countries today, including China, which is one of the largest economies, back in 2006 and 2007 proposed the idea of eco-civilization economy. And in 2015, they actually proposed legislation to move their economy towards an eco-civilization. So there is a lot of stuff that is happening, and the Club of Rome wants to give it more visibility, give it a stronger voice. So that's what we are trying to do through our activity hubs, which are on rethinking economics, reformulating finance, reconceptualizing what new civilizations would look like. These are the different activity hubs in which the work of the Club of Rome is done.
Yes, it's such an important message. You touched on so many things there, but also just rethinking what capitalism is and what it can be. As you know, the world's top 1% have more wealth accumulated than 95% of humanity, according to the new Oxfam analysis of UBS data. And we have books like Rusha Sharma's book, What Went Wrong with Capitalism, that came out earlier this year. Just looking at how a century of expanding government has distorted financial markets, this idea of exponential growth stoked massive inequality. And he says, and others have been saying for a long time in the Club of Rome since the beginning, that it's time to bet against American capitalism and exceptionalism, or perhaps redesign capitalism in a way that works for all of us, not just the top 1% or the wealthy few.
Yes, I think you're absolutely right that the inequalities that have been created over the last 100 years have distorted even the principles of capitalism as it was originally conceived. Capitalism is not one thing. It has been around for 500 years. And over that time, you and I and the public have given it certain rights to do certain things in certain ways. They're all legal rights, but they've just accumulated them to a point that in the United States, a corporation is a person, and a person who has more rights than all the human rights that we have. So it is in our interest and it is our responsibility to reshape the rules of capitalism and to make sure that it both reduces the inequalities, the extreme inequalities, as well as allows the development of a healthy planet, that it doesn't extract the life system out of a healthy planet. Can that be done? Are there good ideas for doing it? My answer to that is yes. In the last 50 to 75 years, we have learned so much about the nature of what's going on to Earth systems as a whole. whether they're mountains or forests or oceans or land masses. So we have tremendous amount of scientific knowledge. We have also a political understanding of the downsides of this extreme inequality and the advent of climate change because of the way we are utilizing our resources. So I think the science is clear. Now, we also understand that there are barriers to change because the current system benefits some people, privileges some ideas, and it's taken 500 years to evolve. It's not going to change in the next year or two or five or 10. It's a transformation process that we need to put into place. The Club of Rome has proposed 5 transformations in Earth for All, a report that came out in 2022 as a 50-year sort of anniversary report. And in that, we suggest transformations that involve eliminating poverty, reducing inequalities, empowering women, changing the food system, and changing the energy system. And we articulate the roles for businesses, for corporations, for governments, for consumers, for all the stakeholders that will be required to act. It is not the responsibility of just one sector. This has to be done together, and it has to be done in a collaborative way. And if we put an antagonistic lens that it is billionaires versus the poor, we are not likely to find a solution that easily. So we look for something in which each party can respectfully understand each other's positions and move towards that optimum solution that will be good for all. It will be good for the billionaires too, not just in accumulating the billions, but in making sure that the earth survives in a way where they can spend their billions.
Indeed. And you talk about billionaires, and we've seen now billionaires exerting new levels of control over economies and the political landscape. Elon Musk, of course, we're told gave $250 million to the Trump campaign and even offering people money if they went out to vote. So if that's not buying people and influencing elections, I don't know what is. So how do you see the future of our electoral story? Will AI accelerate the game of persuading and influencing the masses as a species? I mean, obviously, that's transforming every sector of society as well. AI, it's a boon for remedies, perhaps for cancer and different things, but then widening inequality, biases, and, you know, it just accelerates everything.
So you're absolutely right. I agree. The kind of experience we went through in the last 4 months with the election and what we witnessed in terms of money influencing politics, not just Elon Musk's $240-50 million, but there are lots of other billionaires who have poured money into the political campaign on both sides, not just for Trump, but also for the Democrats. And so while the economic wealth production system is broken, I think our political system is also broken. I mean, we allow this kind of money politics to prevail. We make laws for this kind of flawed democracy to emerge, and we need to fix that also. How do we fix it? So what I see in these risks that you pointed out, both the climate change and the biodiversity loss and AI, is that we are now, these risks are rising to the level of what I call existential risks. They threaten the human survival, the human imaginary in the current form. And the response to it needs to be in the form of existential opportunities. It can't be just transforming a small piece here and a small piece there, whether it is the definition of democracy or the finance influencing democracy. We need to rethink what it means to be human in the Anthropocene. The Anthropocene poses many, many challenges, ecosystem challenges, social polycrisis, all of that. So what does it mean to rethink what it means to be human? To me, these opportunities can be designed around the two principles I mentioned earlier, which is regenerative living and eco-civilization. Those are ways of thinking about us as humans that will help us to jointly address the existential risks that are now facing humanity. A word or two about AI. I think AI is sort of inevitable in some ways. It is not very I right now. It's not very intelligent. It is probably AS, which is artificial stupidity. But it's a question of time before it becomes smarter and smarter. And we need to tackle the right use question and the value question now as it is developing. It can put on steroids and it can amplify both the positive possibilities as well as the negative consequences. And we want to make sure that it is benefiting the largest number of people on Earth and Earth systems themselves. Are there guidelines? Are there principles? There are subgroups within Club of Rome who are looking at AI, who are proposing a constitution for AI and trying to influence the development, understanding fully well that almost $300 billion has been poured into AI already by the United States venture capital, and it is going to start having impacts. So we can't stop it, but while the train is moving, we are trying to make sure some guardrails get into place that everybody plays by. So all these transformations have to happen together in order to have an overall impact. And all of us need to get involved.
Indeed. And in terms of education and AI and these knowledge systems, and we talk about it's being important to maintain biodiversity on this planet, but we also need a biodiversity of thought, right? And so it's interesting, we're kind of drowning in data and, you know, AI provides all of this, but you've pointed out, and we can see that it can reinforce biases and also lead to this, you talk about the heavy investment of the United States and other countries, but right now the United States, like, seeking to be the AI of choice. And even though there's all this data and information out there, it just will dominate systems. So we do have to be very cautious about that, because something that you mentioned earlier on in the conversation was regenerative knowledge in the past. And where you come from in India, you know, have this intergenerational knowledge, what was passed on generationally. You didn't throw out the old information, you built upon that. And I fear for all that AI can promise, it's this next shiny new thing, and we kind of throw out and we disrespect the older and sometimes slower ways of doing things for all that's shiny and new and faster, which, as you pointed out, from whether it's regenerative farming and all these things, these slower ways, you know, there are many ways that our ancestors knew what they were doing. We don't need to throw out all those old ways because they were actually more in harmony with the planet.
Yeah, absolutely. Not only is it an intergenerational question, but this tendency for the techno-industrial shiny object to dominate is even suppressing our own humanness. So humans absorb knowledge in many ways. It's not just an intellectual cognitive thing. We have emotional knowledge, and we have social knowledge, and we have traditional knowledge systems, and we have faith-based knowledge. What these techno-industrial knowledge systems are doing is suppressing all of those. So we don't trust our own emotions. We are asked to actually doubt our emotion. We are actually asked to leave our subjectivity. And we call this science, and we call it progress. So we need to be a little bit more thoughtful about what constitutes knowledge and wisdom. And much of this wisdom comes from our bodies. Much of it comes from nature that we interact with on a day-to-day basis. Not some abstract concept of rainforest or oceans, but from the moment you walk out and experience a form of knowledge through your own perceptions. And we have learned to devalue it. This is, I think, short-sighted. It ultimately transforms us into automatons of some sort, and we need to be guarded against it. I have, in my work, attempted to bring about a more unitary understanding of knowledge, where it's not just scientific, it also includes the social sciences, the humanities, the arts. And for 5 years, I ran this UNESCO chair for integration of arts and science in implementing sustainable development goals at the ICN Business School in Nancy. And we learned how important it is for us to be holistic, because the transformation needs to be holistic. And we can segment ourselves into digital or other worlds that we participate in periodically, but that's not all of us. That is a part of us. I think our destiny as humans to realize our full potential includes these multiple forms of knowledge.
And it's understanding that this embodied learning, and if we look towards the natural world, the non-human animals, who, for all our sophistication, they work and collaborate with a lot of synchronicity. You only have to look at starlings, their dance, their flight to the sky, or shoals of fish and coral reefs and all these things that have another kind of next level intelligence. It's not all about the individual action. It's about getting society to work in harmony and maybe remember the natural circularity of the natural natural world that we are a part of. And I know that you're talking about bringing this embodied learning into management, into business, and other ways where I think this kind of synchronicity, which we also know has health benefits as well, we feel happier when we're working as a group and we have this sense of oneness.
Yes, I think it's a kind of evolution of consciousness that we need to experience. Not everybody is there, but I think being human allows us the ability to draw and to grow. And I feel that that is what I'm trying to argue for when I talk about embodied learning. Use your body to learn, or emotional learning, learning with passion about nature or about people or about communities. So I think what I'm trying to point out is the potential of what it means to be human in the future. Some of our humanity is going to be dominated by technology. There is no question about it. I mean, we benefit by prosthetic devices. You are wearing glasses. I'm wearing hearing aids. I'm wearing a heart valve. By the time you reach my age, you've got many of these technological enhancements, if you will. But we can't be just seduced by that. It has to play a role in the bigger meaning seeking that we are engaged in. What is it that is meaningful for humans? What is the purpose of our lives? We need to be rethinking that and give place to technology and economics, etc. But realize that we are part of that bigger consciousness that is unifying. It is more holistic. It almost sounds somewhat spiritual. I mean, each of these words comes with a lot of baggage with it. So I want to be careful that people who are listening to this podcast don't misinterpret that. Science is very important. Technology is very important. Economics is important, but it's not the whole thing. The big system, each one of us has to manifest for ourselves. And it depends to some degree on our own skills, our cognitive, our emotional, our spiritual skills. And each of us will reach it to a different level. That is the eco-civilization future I'm imagining. A lot of it also needs to be fleshed out. There's not a single ecological future or a single eco-civilization out there. There are probably many of them. We need to design our own lives and our livelihoods to meet our eco-civilizational future.
It's so interesting. I've had many discussions with scientists who also find within that a space for either wonder or spiritual practices. You know, you can't but look at the universe and the natural world and think a miracle of a planet that we live on, whether you're religious or not, it's just the balance, the earth systems, you know, how is that designed? So I think we have to look at it with humility, whatever our faith may be. I'm wondering what you're up bringing, you know, you grew up in India in Bhopal, and of course, I hope maybe we'll discuss as well. I believe it was one of the world's worst industrial disasters there. But to stay a moment on, you know, what your upbringing in India gave you in terms of your awakening. I mean, do you even remember? Was it just like always with you?
Yeah, I do remember a few things about my upbringing that I think helped shape my system's view. And so on the one hand, Hinduism, which is a multi-god religion, and they have an understanding of cosmology that is multi-lifetime. You don't end your life in this one. You kind of reincarnate your soul into another one. So they have this big cosmological picture, which is what created a sense of wonder and awe in me right from childhood. Like, oh my God, we are not just living in this house, in this neighborhood, in this town, in this country, in this world. There is this whole big thing with time and space. So it kind of unbounded my physical existence. On the other hand, the same precepts of religion and caste system within the Hindu religion was another mind opener. Like, we are imposing these rules, systemic rules, on our own lives, which are privileging some people, privileging some ideas, and denouncing other people and ideas. It is so patently arbitrary and unfair. And I started to bring that critique of arbitrariness and unfairness and boundedness of systems, not just to the caste system, but to all the systems. I studied engineering as a young adult, and it was all about systems and how do you create them. And so I was keenly perceptive that systems analysis broadly lacks a kind of self-reflectivity about its own boundaries. It doesn't allow non-material things, spiritual things, to enter. And to some degree, the club Rome's work also suffers from that. We do a lot of systems analysis of material systems, but don't incorporate the spiritual, the emotional, the subjective as strongly into it, the artistic, the aesthetic, etc. And one of my goals now at the Club of Rome is to open up the dialogue to include these human systems that are in many ways driving what's happening to the earth systems.
I mean, for so many reasons, you have to, like, for one reason, to get people to care. It's an emotional story. They have to understand it that way. There are things beyond logic and reason, because in many ways, as you know, as clever as we are with all of our inventions, sometimes we're not logical with the things we invent. So we have to bring in that emotional aspect to get people to care and to commit their time, I think, and then open up for that sense of wonder. And then also for those experiences, you know, when we're talking about moving towards a true circular economy, there's so many reasons for joy that can't be commodified. So I think if you stimulate those more, people don't need to fill that with so many objects that weigh down our planet.
Yeah, and my view is that emotions are already in. We try to keep them out of where they already are. We suppress them. I mean, I would love to have an educational system that allowed children to retain that sense of wonder and that emotionality that makes them children. And in our hurry to grow up and become rational, because rational gets rewarded by a rational economy, we have distorted many parts of being human. And we systematically keep on suppressing and distorting it. So it might be that at some point, at least some humans will realize the power and the utility of being emotional and being more natural to who they are and embracing nature in more naturalistic ways than we currently do through our socialized ideas about what nature is and what we can do with it. Because the socialized ideas are the ones that are destroying nature. They're making nature into asset. And then you put a price on it. And you forget that it's also a tree. And even if you want to just look at it in economic terms alone, a fir tree that's right in front of my house right here is 60 foot tall, and it is taking water from its roots to the top every day. If I were to just take water up and down, I would spend 8 hours taking what it is doing naturally, what it is doing in the soil. It is exchanging carbon. It is exchanging information. It's communicating with the web that's underneath the soil. It's keeping little insects and bacteria alive. So every single tree is a source of wonder. And when I was a child, that came to me naturally. I saw that wonder. And I feel that all this knowledge that I've accumulated over 20 years in colleges and universities and working in those environments has diminished my own humanity. And that is what we want to point out and remove. And I mean, I'm not rejecting science, technology, and all the shiny objects, but we want to adopt them with a lot bigger sense of who we are as humans and our destiny in the long-term future.
Yes, indeed. And it's unfortunate that when we put a price tag on everything, then we forget the value. Again, using economic terms all the time, but we forget, you know, the goodness that is beyond price. Recently, I had a conversation with Carlos Moreno, who's the originator of the 15-minute city concept, which, again, an idea that has been around. But of course, here in Paris, it's been something that's really taken up by Anne Hidalgo and then other mayors around the world. The idea that as industrial as a city can be with its huge populations, a city is also an ecology, just like a forest. And then if we're more cooperative, we can find the joy in those daily interactions. And it's not all about buying and selling, but a community. So what you're saying about widening our emotional aspects beyond our immediate family to our communities, to our cities, so that we get that sense of health and well-being. I feel, and I've seen it, we work together when we care about those around us.
Yeah, and the thing is, I think it's not that difficult to do. This is not like a project that I have to write a strategic plan for. It is a will that I have to exercise in every moment. So my dog is over here. When I interact with my dog, when I go to eat food, when I drink, all of it requires a level of mindfulness that can change the quality of that experience. It is accessible to all of us, without knowledge, without more money, I think we are the final authors of our life. And if we look at these ordinary things, we can make them extraordinary just by our sheer will and experiencing them in a different way. I see this happening in my life, of course, but I also see it happening in the lives of a lot of people. They're not willing to be the automatons that the industrial society calls for. They are exercising their judgment, their discretion in small things, not necessarily in choosing what house to buy. I mean, those decisions also come. You have to choose a house to buy or get a job. But in the day-to-day existence, I think we can make the ordinary special by being more mindful and present with it. And ultimately, it changes the big picture, because I see people changing their livelihoods and changing their communities in order to maintain that integrity of what they want to do in these small, ordinary things. So maybe that's a little bit abstract, but I want to say that we don't have to bring about some great grand resolution at the beginning of the new year and say, I resolve to lose 10 pounds of weight, or it doesn't have to be that way. It can be that we just become more mindful of what we are doing in every interaction that we have with other people and with nature and with animals. It is transformative. The ordinary is really the venue of transformation.
Listening to Dr. Srivastava talk about our current scientific, political, and economic systems, I can't help but wonder, why do we privilege a form of human flourishing centered on reason? At what point did we begin treating reason as a defining attribute of our highest human potential? I think the answer to this question has a long philosophical history, beginning with the idea of eudaimonia, a term coined by the ancient Greeks to describe a state of ultimate happiness and moral perfection. For Socrates and Aristotle, the possibility of eudaimonia depends upon our ability to act rationally, and therefore virtuously. Only reason, they claim, can guide us towards the morally right kinds of actions. From those actions, everything else will follow: strong social relationships, economic wealth, political well-being, and so on. Somewhere in the 13th century, the Greek concept of eudaimonia found its way into Christian doctrine. Then, during the Enlightenment, it reappeared in the works of Kant and Hegel, who saw eudaimonia as the culmination of a grand process in which humanity realizes its rational potential. Crucially, though, they didn't treat this as just an abstract notion of perfection. They believed it had to be embodied and upheld by the concrete institutions of the state. In that sense, the best possible society, that which we ought to strive for, became the rational state, and the most desirable socio-political relationships were likewise those grounded in reason. As Dr. Srivastava points out, these ideas have left a strong mark on the systems that shape our everyday lives, from how we govern ourselves to how we conduct business. Yet when we look closely at their intellectual heritage, it becomes clear that reducing eudaimonia to a purely rational framework means adopting an ideal that overlooks the aesthetic, spiritual, and other historically rich facets of our humanity, none of which can be captured by reason alone. And that, as Heidegger famously warns us, is the real peril of a tradition that puts reason on a pedestal. It forgets the deeper question of what it means to be human, and in the process, obscures the many other avenues through which we understand our place in the world and in each other's lives. The trick, then, is to heed Dr. Srivastava's challenge and envision a kind of human flourishing that extends beyond the rational. As we strive to create the best states, economies, or societies, we must embrace the multiplicity of a human experience that refuses to fence itself off in an ivory tower of pure cognition. In short, we must work to remember what it means to be human, even in the shadow of a history that beckons us to forget. And now, back to the interview.
And so you mentioned the ordinary becoming extraordinary just by bearing witness. You've lived in India, and perhaps you could share with us some meaningful memories of your encounters with the beauty and wonder of the natural world, maybe beyond the ordinary, or something that you feel like, oh, this is something, and it's why you continue, you know, the fight.
Yeah, I think the one that I would like to share is an experience as a youth when in 1984, you referenced that accident in Bhopal. That was very transformative for me. I had lived in the city for 22 or 3 years. That was my hometown. I grew up there. I did engineering there. And I did engineering with the aspiration of transforming a poor region of the country into something more prosperous, because the definition of prosperity at that time in the 1950s and 60s when I was growing up involved this industrial vision. And the accident in 1984 showed me that the promise of this industrial shining object is deeply flawed. It does not include a vision of being human. And it transformed my professional life going forward. I started looking at the downsides of industrialism and technology and capitalism and trying to figure out how do we make improvements to bring in that humanness, the compassion, the connection between people and nature that would make us more complete. So it was an eye-opener for me that we were, at that time at least, as a country, trying to go down this path that the Western civilization had been down for the last 100 years and gained a lot of wealth and prosperity and power, and that was not the path that either some of the leaders in India, like Mahatma Gandhi, had been pointing to. They had been pointing to a much more internally consistent approach that would be needs-driven rather than greed-driven, and we didn't follow it for a variety of political and economic reasons at that time. But it opened my eyes and set me on a trajectory that was very different. I don't think I can point to a specific nature-based event, but I can point to events that I still recall from my childhood that involved animals. And I have seen the hollowing of urban life from animals over the last 70 years that I think is hugely detrimental to humans. Humans are a kind of animal, and we have lived in harmony with animals for the longest time, not in a subjugating animals way, not just like killing 80 billion animals for our food, which to me is not just morally wrong. It's incomprehensible that we do it. I can't understand this because I've had a relationship with animals that has been much more of an equal nature. I feel that everything that I learn about emotions actually is from my dog. How to rely on other people, how to trust other people, those emotions are common to animals. If we were for a moment to give them the due of what they provide to us, we would be treating them very differently. And I had a dog when I was growing up. My grandparents had dogs. So I grew up with that interaction with animals being a very central part of my own learning. So maybe that is something that connects me to nature in profound ways, and it teaches me even today how my ordinary life can be different.
Beautiful thing about human animals that I think in a moment they're watchful they are. And also when we talk about, you know, our emotional life, humans tend to stress themselves out when they don't need to be, but animals, you know, save that for the moment when they need to defend themselves or to hunt or to, you know, they study mindfulness. But if you look at non-human animals, if they've had a reason, if they that's their instinct. They watch and observe so many different ways that they communicate that we can't even understand, through breath and sound and subterranean that elephants and, you know, which is animal in India. We only understand a fraction. To speak as other, you know, human teachers that you've had, you know, who's inspiring? I mean, whether you learn from them directly or through their books or their projects. I mean, you meant Gandhi, yeah. But, you know, that impression upon you that maybe inspired you on your path.
So I think there are many of them, but I will recount a few of, particularly with my own sort of thinking around systems. When I was younger and going through engineering education, there were lots of technological wonders that were happening. I mean, I was in high school and I remember NASA sending people to the moon, and we got a holiday that day. And we went to a little Buddhist stupa in Sanchi, which was like about a 30-mile distance from our house. And we talked to some of the villagers over there. And they said, how come you're not in college? It's a Tuesday. And we said, well, it's holiday because man has reached the moon. And these guys laughed at us. They said, you must have been smoking something because moon is a god. You cannot reach godhood. And they sat down with us for like 2 hours of debate over how profoundly mistaken we were. And at the same time, I was studying engineering and I was looking at all the knowledge that is coming out in science and technology and marveling at what was. It left in me a kind of deep skepticism about the nature of science and technology and the kind of knowledge it was providing. Yes, it was sending people to the moon, but on the other hand, it was leaving behind a lot of people on Earth who had a mindset where they couldn't even imagine that this was possible. possible. There are lots of scientists I can name, from Newton to people who made fundamental paradigm shifts that Kuhn would call. It actually made me read the philosophy of science and the history of science in a different way. And I've retained that skepticism about science. Some of the names besides Mahatma Gandhi who left a big impression. I think on the economic side, there is a Hungarian economist, Karl Polanyi, who back in the 1930s was writing about the great transformation that was needed to create purpose-driven economies, not just economics for wealth creation mindlessly. And I thought his ideas then were very pertinent. They were referring to a different kind of transformation. But even today, I see resonance in that transformational mindset that he brought forward. On the systems thinking side, C. Wes Churchman, a philosopher who worked for NASA and at the University of California in Berkeley, he wrote a book called The Design of Inquiring Systems that left a very profound impact on me, because he sort of encapsulated Western philosophy into four or five systems of thought, such as empiricism and dialecticism, etc. And for the field that was very rich with knowledge, it kind of reduced for me how I could understand that whole Western philosophical systems thinking. So I've carried that with me in my own systems thinking. Also, my intellectual development is not so much driven by literature in different areas. I think the best ideas have come out from the real world. People who transform the world seem to impress me more than philosophers and scientists and intellectuals. So I'll give you a couple of them. Gandhi is a transformative thinker because he transformed India, not because of just his ideas about Satyagraha and the concepts that led to the transformation. The other person that is very impressive to me is Mao. I don't want to minimize the problems of the Cultural Revolution and the number of people that died. But to take a country at that scale and level and point of development and change it into something really different, it is underpinned with certain types of ideas that I think are very powerful, because the transformation did happen. It came at a cost, but I find that very impressive for somebody who takes ideas and then implements them in ways that can be transformative. Unfortunately, we don't have those kind of thinkers now, or at least the authoritarians that are ruling India and the United States and Turkey and parts of Europe now. They don't have either the vision of transformation or the ideas to make it happen. And I think we need that kind of thinking. We need those ideas that have action value. I hope that the Club of Rome as a think tank can take on this challenge to create. And I think planetary peace, which is what we are arguing for, has at least that aspiration, if not the full-fledged development. So I'm not impressed by my own ideas or the ideas of others. I'm impressed with what ideas can do, the action impact of ideas.
But we have to generate the passion, generate the curiosity for others to get behind. And those are great peeps and movements for people to explore. And what you thank you, Dr. Paul Srivastava and the Club of Rome, for sharing your inspiring vision of planetary peace, regenerative living, eco-civilization to improve human and planetary health and education of the world for future generations. We all live on one planet we call home. Thank you for bringing your voice to One Planet Podcast and the creative process.
Thank you very much for reaching out, for engaging me in this dialogue, for giving me the opportunity to share. And I find in your questions and in the conversation a kind of kinship that I feel like you really do get where we are trying to go. And I hope the best for the podcast and look forward to listening to it once again. Thank you.
The Creative Process and One Planet Podcast is supported by the Jan Michalski Foundation. This interview was conducted by Mia Funk with the participation of collaborating universities and students. Associate interview producers on this episode were Katie Foster and Virginia Moschetti. One Planet Podcast is produced by Mia Funk. Additional production support by Sophie Garnier. Theme music is written and performed by Juan Sanchez. We hope you've enjoyed listening to this podcast. If you'd like to get involved with our creative community exhibitions, podcasts, or be a part of the climate change solution, just drop us a line at team@creativeprocess.info. Thank you for listening.